you guys see.
House Transportation for Friday, April the 20th.
Good morning.
We'll come to order. Committee, we've got session that starts, I believe, this morning at 10 o'clock. Somebody tell me I'm wrong. I think I'm right. That means we have less time than normal and a larger than normal schedule.
Let's go.
So we need to run through our bills as quickly as we can. We've got amendments on things. We just need to get the work done. We may be a little late to the floor this morning. If committee will hang in there, I want to get through this agenda. We don't need to be on the floor unless they call us to the floor this morning. Maybe we'll just get done before floor session anyway. House Bill 3363, if anybody's here to testify on that bill, we're just going to do a tap hearing.
3663.
Yeah, so with that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3663, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3663. And new committee members, you'll see a lot more of that in the next week. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2705. John, can you...
Yes, Chair Sark, members of the committee, you have before you for the second hearing, House Bill 2705 that requires ODOT to provide driver and motor vehicle services at least 2 days per month to a city with a population of at least 2,000 persons that is not more than 30 miles from nearest full-service driver and motor vehicle office. Members, you should have your Dash 5 amendment for you. The proposed amendment does several things. First, it requires DMV to provide full services at least 1 day per week in city with population minimum of 3,000 and not more than 6,000 and is beyond the 25 miles to the nearest DMV office. It requires DMV to provide full services at least 1 day per week in an unincorporated city of a minimum population of 5,000 and the nearest DMV office, and of course all the amendments I should just say are all the issues, is beyond the 25 miles. It has that condition on all of them. Requires DMV also to provide full services 2 days per week in city with a minimum of 6,000 in population, and also defines type of services DMV will provide. Also allows DMV to enter agreements with local governments regarding office space, use of equipment and employees, as well as non-DMV employees to act as agents for the department. Members, as you recall, you have the fiscal from the original bill from the last hearing. However, because of the proposed Dash 5, we will need a new fiscal on this bill, which we've not received. And of course, you see the fiscal figures or impact on the original bill, and that is rather significant. If this amendment is adopted, it will be even a more significant impact, and therefore, if you do pass this bill, it will be referred away from me. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you. Money. Representative King. I have Monty King on my brain. Representative King and Mayor Hampton, please come together.
And Dwayne's going to do
it. And Dwayne, that would be great.
So we have a testimony team.
These are the three witnesses, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to proceed.
For the record, I'm not Monty King. And Al King, State Representative District 44.
Representative King, it's a good thing this morning you're not Monty King.
Char related, though.
Well, we want to know who that is.
I'm going to yield to Dwayne to get us started, if I could, and we'll take this couple.
Perfect. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Starr and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dwayne Bales with the Speaker's Office. And as you will recall, several weeks ago, we had two bills before you that deal with the DMV offices. One was House Bill 2705, which we're considering this morning, and the other was House Bill 3591, which was the Speaker's bill. After that hearing, we met together in a work group with Representative King, myself, a representative from ODOT, and a representative from Milton Freewater, and we decided to bring the two bills together and put them into House Bill 2705 with some amendments, and those are the Dash 5 amendments that you have before you. And as the committee administrator mentioned, this is a way of providing services for residents who live in areas that are 3,000 persons to 6,000 persons. They would provide an office, full service office, 1 day a week if they're 25 miles or more from the DMV another DMV office. It would allow for one full day a week for a DMV office to be opened if there's at least 5,000 persons in an unincorporated area, and then at least 2 days per week if there's 6,000 or more and residents in an area. So the speaker, unfortunately, was unable to attend this morning's hearing, would have liked to testify, but he had another prior commitment, so he asked me to come in his place. He does support these amendments and believes this is very important to our district, and this is a way of providing needed services that right now are lacking because of the closure of the DMV office in Milton Freewater.
Thank you, Dwayne. Representative King?
Thank you. Everybody stole my thunder on going through the explanation of the amendments, so I'll move on to other things. I do want to say that I am supportive of a fiscal that will come associated with this bill. On the other hand, I think this bill needs to come forward, whether the fiscal is $1 or a larger sum, in order to provide the service that does need to be done all along, but that's an issue primarily, I think, for the Ways and Means Committee. That something that I think would be helpful to add is if you pay attention to Section 2, we see ways where the DMV does not need to provide service, that's identical to the service that they had in the past, as the local governments are willing to work with DMV to be able to lower the costs. I think the rent projections, were high. Mayor Hampton may be, speaking to that. Also with local cooperation, there may be some staff available so that they don't need a second person, because in the course of doing this work, we realize that that sometimes somebody has to leave the office to go do the driving test. You can't leave your records, exposed there to people that might be there, waiting, for their service. Or that occasionally you're going to have a patron that that might become unreasonable, and that, a DMV employee would need to have some backup to be able to deal with what might be an uncomfortable situation, and local cooperative efforts, can provide some coverage from that. Maybe they can hand out some application forms for people while they're waiting, to help, speed the process along. I should point out that also this bill does not cover every community that lost service, and so I have, shared the status report of this bill with some of the other members who have some communities that, that are affected, and I think that they may bring forward some amendments that the committee can take a look at and try and determine, where to draw a line, how many communities we can bring back into service. I'm certainly supportive of that effort. I think that's enough, for the moment. I would also like to point out that Don Hampton and I ran against each other when I first ran, for my race, and the more we got to be doing the campaign stump, I realized that he wasn't somebody I necessarily wanted to beat. He was someone I wanted to clone. He's just a real.
All right.
Wonderful. Chairman Starr and members of the committee, I thank you for taking the time to consider this House Bill 2705 and the proposed amendments.
You have to say your name for the record.
Oh, for the record, I'm Donald Hampton, mayor of the city of Oak Ridge. I also appreciate the time that DMV officials have taken to hear our concerns. What I want to tell you today are some of the kind of grassroots impacts of the DMV office closure that I would hope that you would figure into the whole equation of DMV service for the state of Oregon. We're certainly aware that there are budgetary constraints and that this was an attempt by DMV to solve those. But we think that the process that they used lacked some logic. And the reason that I say that is because all communities aren't the same. For example, the way it had impacted our community is that we now have the furthest distance to drive to reach a DMV office. And our driving is not freeway driving. Our driving is mountain highway driving, and that's certainly a different factor, especially in the wintertime. There are also associated what we call social costs. So you've got things like people having to take off work to commute to Springfield, the closest office. And, of course, what happens is if we have lost wages, then you have lost taxes. The additional cost of gasoline to the people that have to go there, and the wear and tear on the highway, which is also a part of the amount of money that you have to figure into ODOT. Then, of course, there are insurance costs and repair and maintenance for the people that have to drive their personal vehicles to Springfield. So I think it's a lot more complex than just saying we're going to close an office and save X number of dollars. Also, we're not unlike a lot of other rural communities in that we have an increasing senior population. And it's obviously much more difficult for those people to have to make a long drive to receive DMV services. We do appreciate the increased online services that DMV offers, but there are still more complex transactions that people need to make. And so these Oak Ridge citizens then have no choice but to travel to Springfield or a Eugene office for those services. It actually makes it more difficult for us in rural Oregon to comply with state mandates and law. So there are increased cost burdens with expenses of time, travel, lost wages, and lost opportunity, and at the same time, decreased services that you're providing to us. But we have to find a way to use those services. So we think that there was something fundamentally wrong with the way that with the solution that was adopted. For example, at one point in the process, there was an analogy made about closing our office and closing an office, I believe, in Gresham. But a person who lives in Gresham who commutes to Portland to work may pass two or three DMV offices on his or her way, whereas in our case, ours was the only office, and that means a 35-mile drive to get to the next closest office. Our town, not like a lot of other rural Oregon towns, has been struggling because we lost 1,200 jobs and about a third of our population as a result of the decline in the timber industry. What we're trying to do is to revitalize our economy, to diversify our economy, and in order to do that, we must make our community as attractive as, say, Willamette Valley communities. So services are very important to us. We have purchased the old mill site and are attempting to turn it into an industrial park, and we do have tenants there, and we're kind of on the upswing, and this DMV office closure was, I guess, from our perspective, something that was going in the wrong direction. Also, with so much concern being expressed these days with an increase in population in the Willamette Valley, our town is actually looking to increase its population. We're hoping to provide more jobs. We have the capacity to have more population. We do not want to have a good share of our citizens having to drive to Eugene, Springfield every day just to go to work. We want to be able to provide them with jobs in town, but in order to make our town attractive, we have to have some of the same services that the Willamette Valley towns have.
Mayor Hampton, if I can just interrupt. This committee, I believe, intends to help you. Mm-hmm. We intend to move this bill to the Ways and Means Committee, where we can find the necessary money. There's another bill we plan to move today that will increase the amount of money the DMV will have to operate. I believe that that your situation in Oak Ridge, as well as the situation in Milton Friedwater and perhaps some other areas around the state, will find themselves with the DMV offices relocated in their communities. If you could perhaps summarize your testimony, I think we're in a good shape up here.
All right. Just yesterday, I was given a copy of the amendment. I would just say that our community stands ready to implement any and all of the suggestions in
Section 2
of the amendment. And we have talked in our conversations with DMV, we have talked about these things before. So I believe that they know that we stand ready to assist them in re-providing service to us.
Thank you very much. And thank you for coming. Very much. I appreciate it. Are there any questions? Thank you all for your testimony. Thanks for your work on the amendments. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2705, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2705. Representative Donner.
Does that have to go to Ways and Means?
Yes, it does, but we need to adopt the amendment first. We need to move the -5 amendments. Representative Donner has moved the -5 amendments to House Bill 2705. Is there discussion? Is there objection? So moved. Representative Donner?
Chair Starr, I'd like to move 2705 to Ways and Means as amended.
Representative Donner has moved House Bill 2705 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. That's a due pass recommendation.
You got it.
Is there objection? And none, so moved. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2705. Thank you very much. Representative Krupp, are you ready to go?
I am.
Okay. We'll next go to... Where's my agenda? Here we go. Next, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2567. John, will you give us a up on that bill?
Absolutely, Chair Starr, members of the committee, you have before you House Bill 2565 that requires State Parks and Recreation Commission to allow persons 65 years of age and older to hold specified licenses or discount cards to use individual campsites at reduced rate in any state park or day use fee area without charge. Requires commission to adopt system for issuing long-term resident discount cards. There is no revenue impact on this bill. However, I have spoken with the state parks and commission, and this bill, if passed out of committee, would need to go to Ways and Means because it would have a significant fiscal impact. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you. Representative Krupp.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, District 37. I'll be brief. I know that's hard for you to believe, but I'll try. House Bill 2567 is a bill that has been brought forward by myself at the request of my very good friend who is sitting to the right of me here, Mr. Stanley Carruthers, former chief engineer of our local fire department, fellow firefighter with me, good friend, supporter, and had a great idea and that I thought had merit, so we drafted House Bill 2567, which allows the commission by rule to authorize a special card, which we would charge $10 for, that in essence rewards a senior citizen for having lived in this state for a number of years with a half price fee for using the state's campsites and a free pass for day use parks and so forth. You have to be 70 years of older and you have to have lived here 5 years, and it's called a long-term resident discount card, and the commission can establish a charge of $10 for that. And basically that's what this bill does. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce to you Mr. Stanley Carruthers. And Stan, you'll need to say your name.
Okay. Chair Starr, members of the committee, I'm Stanley Carruthers. As Jeff said, I asked for this bill through him, and I live in Halsey. There's two parts to this bill as far as the ID cards. The first part uses the Pioneer and Senior Hunting and Fishing licenses, which is an office that is already established, and I would see no further fiscal impact by using those cards for ID. The card that is requested of the Parks Department to be issued, I realize that would cost some money, and in tight budget times and such, maybe that is not really feasible to have that part in the bill. If that part was deleted from the bill, it would not really hurt giving the seniors of this state a pat on the back for paying taxes and loving their state, and also give them a chance to camp and use the they use fee areas free of charge. Thank you. If there's any questions, I would be happy to answer them if I can.
Great. Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because you already have the pass to go fishing, I'm assuming you probably would take advantage more of the day use of the campground rather than camping at night, because at our age, I can't believe we'd sleep in tents anymore.
I, Representative Zahner, I also have problems sleeping on the ground. It's hard. Not like I was when I was young. I would go with your idea that the day use areas would probably be used a lot more than maybe the camping, although camping would. One thing that the day use area use would do, and we both know that the use of restrooms for the older people come quite a bit more often than the young ones, and I personally have found it very hard to find a restroom to use because the service stations and the stores and so on, they want you to buy something. You don't always need something. And to get into a restroom in a state park, it costs you $3 or more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Merkley. Thank you. I just wanted to ask a question about the five-year residency requirement. I've had the impression that long-term residency requirements are, in general, run into various constitutional problems. But that's just an impression I have. Apparently not, since this has come through LC. Was there any discussion of any problems surrounding a five-year residency?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, since you happened to ask, we did have a conversation with Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel, regarding to our original draft. And he did say that there has been a Supreme Court case in 1999 out of California that said you couldn't discriminate between long-term residents and newly arrived residents when issuing welfare benefits. So I'm just reading this here. The problem is we already do this because we offer discounted licenses to long-term residents, and they think, in essence, legislative council says a constitutional challenge on that basis is probably pretty minimal. They don't think it's a big deal, in essence, and so it doesn't mean that it couldn't be challenged, Representative, but we're already doing it, hasn't been challenged.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lori Warner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, Deputy Director for Oregon State Parks. I'm here to give some testimony related to how the state park system currently handles discounts, and I'll be brief and then be available to answer any questions for you. The Oregon State Park system currently offers a number of discounts that can be applied to camping and day use. Specifically to the day use program, the day use fee is annually is $25 right now that allows you access to all the day use areas on an unlimited basis. In December every year, we offer that pass at a discount of $5. So for $20, you can have that annual pass good all year long. And the normal day use fee every day, if you were to enter without the pass, is $3. The Oregon State Park System also works with the federal folks, and we offer a coastal passport program currently that allows you to use 15 state and local parks along the Oregon coast for $35 per year or $10 for a five-day pass. In terms of the camping rates, the off-season for the state parks we consider to be October 1st through April 30th, and at that time, campground rates drop about $4 per night for the entire period, and there's an additional discount for those who purchase a coupon book that we have for 10 nights for $77. There is also a $6 per night or a $6 reservation fee that's waived for people who do group camping for at least 10 days in the summer and 5 days in the winter. These discount programs were established by the commission and are consistent with kind of a long-term policy of offering across-the-board discounts to all Oregonians and visitors rather than specific individuals or groups. The policy is based on the belief that if you give a discount to one group, no matter how deserving, there's always another group that's also deserving, and how do you sort those out? There's always contentious debate sort of over those issues and which groups deserve the discounts and which don't. So the commission has adopted the discount in the off-season. The current discount policy has also the advantage for the system of being simplest to administrate because it basically allows everyone to use that system. It also speeds up telephone and online reservations because we don't have to verify the status of the person who's making the reservation at the time they do that. Under this proposed bill, qualifying seniors would have camping fees capped at $10 per night. They would also be exempt from the day use fees, and the department would need to develop a discount card. A survey conducted in 1999 by Tennessee State Parks showed that there were 16 states offering senior discounts at that time. Three of those were in the West, California, Colorado, and Hawaii. The discounts range from 14% to 25% among the 16 states. The discount proposed in House Bill 2567, based on our average rate of $17 per night, is 41%. The average rate's a conservative figure, which means the percentage would be higher than that for the more expensive campsites that we offer. Either way, it's a significant discount to a group that is about 10% of our market and who often use some of the most expensive full-service RV hookup sites. The current Discovery Season discount averages 20 to 25%. We estimate that the bill would cost the park system anywhere from $3 to $5 to $6 million, depending on how many nights campers were staying. Most of it would come in the form of the camping fees rather than the day use. We also pay a lodging tax to the local jurisdictions based on the camping rates, so the local governments would have a decrease in their revenues based on these proposed discounts. We believe it's best to consider discounts as in terms of consideration of your overall rate structures. The Ways and Means Committee, which we've just finished in, has added to our 2001-03 budget a note that asks us to take a look at fees, both day use and camping fees, because we are considering rate increases, and report those back to the emergency board. So we would be happy to include this consideration when the commission reviews all of those fees this fall and report back to the emergency board. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Kraft.
Thank you. Lori, any idea if we took the overnight half rate out of this thing and just went with the day use, any idea about how much that might cost?
The day use impact of this, we estimated at $350,000.
Per biennium?
Per biennium.
Other questions? Representative Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you police the day use in all campgrounds, or if they're day use only, maybe campgrounds? Do we have day use only campgrounds that don't have an overnight camping?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We have day use only areas, and the day use fee is currently charged at 26 parks, and we do enforcement work in terms of monitoring that people that are there do have the day use pass, either the individual single day pass or the multi-yearly pass.
Follow up, when you say monitoring, do you have somebody there all the time at campground to watch the people come in and out, or do you periodically go through and...
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, we periodically have the park rangers go through. They're not there. They don't spend full time policing that activity, except in the summer season when we staff a booth at some of these day use areas where you essentially just can't get in unless you actually go through the booth, and then it leases everybody at one point.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
I also have a bill floating around out here somewhere in Never Never Land, probably, but it's a bill that I introduced that it's for the people that had the salmon plate on their vehicle, that would suffice for the day use fee in the parks. I suppose that bill's probably going to die of a death somewhere out there, but it's floating around.
Mm-hmm. It's actually scheduled for a tap-tap hearing next Friday.
Is it? It still has life in.
Fish on.
But it will generate the same similar kind of fiscal that this bill would.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2567. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2139. John, can you...
Secretary Starr, members of the committee, you have before you what has become known as the DMV fee bill. It's House Bill 2139. It establishes and adjusts certain fees for the Oregon Department of Transportation. It has an emergency clause, takes effect October 1st on passage of this year. I'd like to review briefly for you the amendments, all the amendments that you have before you. The Dash 1 increases vehicle dealer certificate fees to $1,200 with lower fees for dealers dealing primarily in manufactured dwellings. Creates a three-tiered renewal fee levels for dealers who annually sell less than 300 vehicles and 300 to 1,000 vehicles or more than 1,000 vehicles. Eliminates fee increases for vehicle transporter certificate, driver training certificate, commercial driver training school certificate, and appraiser certificate. That's the Dash 1. The Dash 2 creates a $90 fee instead of $230 for each additional vehicle dealer certificate for places of business dealing primarily in manufactured dwellings. The Dash 3 amendment creates three-tiered vehicle dealer certificate renewal fee levels for franchise dealers and national auctioneers, $1,200, and dealers dealing primarily in manufactured dwellings, $500, and single places of business, $600. The Dash 4 amendment that you have before you eliminates fee increases for disabled parking permits. The Dash 5 amendment is rather simple. It increases the issuance or renewal fees for various licenses, driver's permits, and endorsements to $8. And you also have before you the Dash 6 amendment, and basically to keep it simple because all of them are real simple, is that on the graduated fees that I just referred to regarding the dealers, you have some changes as far as the graduated fees are concerned. There is, I do not have a revenue statement yet either. It says it may have a potential revenue impact. Obviously, we know definitely, members, that there is going to be a significant fiscal impact on this bill. And based on the original statement you have before you, you can see it generates $33 million for the department for the first biennium and almost $40 million for the second biennium. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you very much for your description. And before I call other witnesses up, I just want to highlight for the committee that the chair intends to focus primarily on the Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments today. The business regulation fees that we're increasing because of the Attorney General's letter of counsel that says that state highway fund dollars cannot be used in dealer regulation. I'm sure some of that testimony will come forward. Then the Dash 6 amendments limit the fee increases to five areas rather than in every fee that's listed in the bill. And we will obviously have more testimony about that as we go forward today. We've got testimony from ODOT, from the counties, and from some of the regulated industries this morning. So with that, if we can have Bruce Warner and Lorna Youngs come up, please.
Go ahead, Bruce.
morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here to just provide you a brief introduction before I turn this over to Lorna Youngs, who is the manager of the DMV operations and programs. I wanted to thank the committee, first off, for hearing this bill. It's an important bill to the department and to our customers. We've requested this bill to raise fees for certain DMV transactions to accomplish three objectives, which you'll hear about a little bit more. And those are to, number one, stop the subsidy of DMV services by the Highway Fund by raising fees to cover the costs of those DMV services. The second reason is to ensure that the programs that have been determined ineligible for highway funds by the Attorney General are supported by fees that are adequate to cover program costs. And then three, to restore reductions in DMV service delivery and provide funding for infrastructure investments. I understand that last session the department discussed with you our concerns about the growing gap between costs and revenue generated to the highway fund from current DMV fee structure, and again, obviously, the impact on our ability to address services and programs that you want on the highway side. The condition of Oregon's state, county, and city roads and bridges make it crucial that all funds that are meant to go to the highway fund actually reach that fund. The Attorney General's office recent review of proper use of highway funds identified changes that we do need to make, and this bill will help us address some of those changes. And finally, we would like to restore reductions made to DMV service delivery and make investments our customers are asking us to provide, such as DMV services using the Internet. And I believe you heard from the mayor of Oak Ridge, who talked about some of the things we're doing on the Internet now. We obviously like to see that expanded and improved. And then also improving driver safety for everyone on the road. Lorna Youngs, who is a deputy director for the Oregon Department of Transportation, also the manager of DMV, is with me today to outline the background of the bill, explain its effect, and answer any questions you might have. So for that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Youngs, if I could.
Thank you, Bruce. Go ahead, Lorna.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lorna Youngs, deputy director for ODOT for the DMV. As the director just stated, there are three purposes for the bill: to stop or to restore the revenue stream from the registration fee back to the highway fund, to make sure that we have covered the cost for those programs that are not eligible for highway funds, and to restore service delivery to the DMV. During the last session, we alerted the Ways and Means Committee to the fact that over time, because fees had not been adjusted to encompass changes in programs and changes of cost of living, that there were a number of fees, especially on the driver's side and the non-registration vehicle side of the house, that should have a good hard look at them to see whether or not they were covering costs. We were directed to do so and reported back during the interim to the July Ways and Means Emergency Board Committee to talk about which fees we had analyzed and determined needed to have some kind of adjustments. And that report is appended to the testimony that we provided to Ways and Means. House Bill 2139 contains those fees that we determined needed to be adjusted in order to cover their costs. In addition, last summer and into the fall, the Attorney General's office was examining the highway fund and its proper use and identified within that group of transactions two areas that were not eligible for the use of highway funds or impartially not eligible. Those also happened to be two areas that were also within our study, and so they're here as well in the fee bill, and that is the transactions associated with dealer regulation or vehicle, what we call business regulation, auto dealers. To the extent that auto dealers are serving as our agent in the process of registration of automobiles, then they can be, and we can appropriately use highway funds. And we determined about 35% of our activity with the vehicle dealers was appropriate use of highway funds. And so we took a look at the remaining program and looked at what we needed to do to adjust our fees in order to cover those costs. In addition, identity cards are an area that doesn't facilitate motorized vehicle traffic. We do it because, of course, we have the expertise, we have the equipment. It makes sense for state DMVs to do that, and they do it all over the nation, but it is not an appropriate use of highway funds, and so we need to make sure that those costs are covered. issuance of the card is covered, but the renewal fee needs to be adjusted or replacement fee needs to be adjusted upward to make sure those costs are covered. So those are the fees that are in House Bill 2139, and you see at the last page of my testimony a list of the various transactions that are covered that need to have their costs adjusted. And then finally, one of the things that we wanted to take a look at with resources from the revenue, it's about, as you see, a $33 million cost for the revenue for the fee bill. We're proposing that about $23 million of that would close, would cover the DMV expenditures and make sure that money should go to the highway fund. In essence, if you take a look at the cost, subtract out all of DMV costs, the gap that needs to be closed to restore the full use of the registration fee to the highway fund is $23 million. We're proposing that $10 million be retained at the DMV to restore service delivery. The earlier testimony, part of the service delivery reductions that we are needing to make this biennium under current service level of this is to continue with office closures, reductions of staff. We will not have funding to expand any of our services, to open the internet door, as there seems to be quite a public interest in that, or expand our efforts to improve driver safety. And so one of the proposals within the governor's recommended budget is that if this fee bill is successful, the revenue would, $10 million of revenue would be retained at the DMV to expand our service and restore services where they've been cut. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Youngs, are these new fee amounts set to reflect the actual cost of the services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, for the most part, the fees are set to recover the cost of services. Now, there is, for example, one fee, the fee for a drive test, which is being offered as a way of offsetting the cost or the cost gap with the driver license. And so there's two goals in that one. One, to cover the cost of the driver license, but also to provide a level playing field with the public, private sector, which is also offering drive tests, which we honor, but they, of course, charge a fee for that. So if the DMV charges a fee for it, then we create a level playing field. So cost recovery and some additional issues were addressed in setting the fees. But for the most part, it was to recover the cost.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. The replacement registration stickers, that one actually is the only one I see that goes down to 10.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we took an advantage of the opportunity during having the fee bill to make adjustments to fees where we have seen a historic decrease because of cost efficiencies, and so that's why we have that one in there.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Berger?
Yes, just for the record, my name is Joanne Berger, and I would like to declare a conflict of interest, potential conflict of interest, certainly, because we are the owners of Berger Chrysler Plymouth Dodge and Jeep, and this fee increase would impact our company. However, what I would like to ask you is, for the doubling of a fee, which you have with the vehicle or a certificate, what services do you actually provide a new car dealership for that fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I don't know if services is exactly how you describe it. The business regulation program is just that. It's a program set up to license automobile dealers and then to essentially audit their activity to make sure that they are abiding by the laws of the state in relationship to dealing with cars. And our primary concern there is consumer protection in order to make sure that vehicle titles are properly transferred and that liens are properly paid off. Now, we also assist dealers in understanding what the rules of the road are for dealers, as well as help with education. And they, in turn, serve as agents for us, issuing trip permits, helping in the registration process. So we work as partners to some extent and also as an organization that is essentially a watchdog, as many public agencies are, over business to make sure that that consumer protection is. The service that we might provide, I would say, for the industry is that our goal is to have a level playing field, a good partnership with industry to make sure that everyone is getting a fair deal.
So would you, follow up please, Mr. Chair, would you say that new car dealers are probably some of your more efficient and good customers there at Department of Motor Vehicles as far as being able to be educated in the process and in doing a good job?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I would say that we have good partners across all members of the industry. I don't know if I can characterize anyone as being a better partner than another. Mm-hmm. Certainly, new car dealers have a lot of infrastructure that enables them to be successful in abiding by the law. And we have, but we have good relationships across all of the, of our regulated, or all of the industries that we work with.
Follow up, please, Mr. Vice Chair.
Yes.
Would you consider a phasing in of fees at all rather than a doubling and the severe increase of fees all at one time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, certainly a phasing in is always a consideration. The situation that we're dealing with here with business regulation is the advice of counsel from the Attorney General, which has stated that within limits, we can support this activity with highway fund, but a great portion of it, 65% of it, as we've taken a look at it, cannot be. So any reduction in revenue would be a corresponding reduction in program.
Okay, follow up. I really agree that you need to make a big adjustment here, mm-hmm. because obviously you can't continue to subsidize a program. The ruling has come at a time when it's an opinion. Is that correct, that it's an opinion of the Attorney General that this particular fee cannot be used for highway? I mean, I could make the argument in my own head that there is a very direct connection between that, but the Attorney General has ruled differently. So because of that, and prior to this, it's been subsidized. Would you say that there would be any subsidies in order for a phase-in program, or would that be out of the question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, we're acting expeditiously to make sure that those programs that are not eligible for highway funds move into another base. So we're phasing in, it can gradually get into compliance as we're trying to get into compliance.
I just guess I would make one comment, and that is that probably for the $350, I see you say $285, I thought you paid $350, but nevertheless, there probably won't be any more work that is being done that hasn't been done in the past. It's just simply that before there was some type of subsidy. Is that correct?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Bridger, that's correct.
All right. Thank you.
Committee members, thank you. I passed out a sheet that shows which fees are included in the Dash 6 and which fees are included in the Dash 5 amendment. And then then this sheet on the upper part of it where you talk about the dealer certificate, it actually doesn't accurately represent the Dash 6 in that the Dash 6 has a graduated fee in it, whereas this shows a fee of $9.58. So, but it raises hopefully nearly about the same amount of money, and yet we have a graduated fee there, and I believe that the auto dealers will highlight that and the negotiations that went into getting everybody on board with that fee. So, are there other questions for Mr. Warner and Ms. Youngs? Thank you very much for your testimony. I think at this time I'd like to have Daryl and Don come up and talk about their respective parts of this bill. And talk about how they put the chair through. We've negotiated this bill.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Fuller, and today I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. After dramatically increasing our licensing fees, I can't assure you that I'll represent it tomorrow. Nevertheless, we're here in support of the Dash 6 amendments. We learned, as the committee has earlier this year, that dealer licensing programs was being supplemented by highway funds in a manner that the Attorney General believes is unconstitutional. And as a result of that, there was a bill introduced to dramatically increase dealer licensing fees. And we looked real hard at it. There's a couple of different ways you can look at it. One is to look at a program and say that auto dealers ought to be embarrassed that we're not covering the cost of our own program over the years, and the fact that we would be using highway funds that's desperately needed to fill potholes and create new roads to have that supplement dealer regulation really isn't something that the industry ought to be proud of. It wasn't being subsidized in a manner in which we were trying to subsidize it. It was simply the numbers weren't connected because we didn't realize there was a constitutional problem. And if you adjusted the licensing fee from the last time it was changed, which is 1985 until today, you adjust it for inflation, then the increase that the bill is asking for is not quite as dramatic. The bill essentially triples the licensing fee. When you adjust it for inflation, we're only doubling the licensing fee. Well, you tell an auto dealer that, and that doesn't provide him much consolation. Nevertheless, the Auto Dealers Association, OADA, which represents new car dealers, philosophically supports the idea of a program that is self-funding as opposed to one that is subsidized. The fee increase, especially having to be done immediately, is pretty significant. And so the chair worked with myself and the Independent Auto Dealers Association, and I will tell you that Monty King, who was referenced at the beginning of the meeting, is in Nashville right now at a meeting, so he's not available to be here today. Don Miner, representing the manufactured housing dealers, and myself got together and started cooking numbers. And one of the primary concerns we had was for smaller dealers who are selling very few cars, that this tripling of a licensing fee would be a tremendous hardship on them. On the other hand, the licensing fee has always been a flat fee. Big dealers and small dealers have always paid the same fee, and that was the position that OADA had taken. But over time, we were convinced by the different players that perhaps what we needed was a field that a licensing fee that was somehow tiered based on a dealer's volume, where the very large metropolitan dealers were paying a higher fee than perhaps somebody who lives in Enterprise, Oregon and owns a dealership there, or in the case of Representative Berger in Coos Bay. And so we, again, started working on the numbers, trying to keep the legislation or changes in the licensing process as revenue neutral as possible for the benefit of DMV, and but nevertheless making the breaks in the tiering in such a way that we reflected the needs of the regulated community. And what we finally came up with was what you see incorporated in the Dash 6 amendments, which initially, if you're a new dealer and you don't have a record in terms of the number of vehicles you sell because you're brand new, you would pay the middle of the three tiers, and then which is $900 for a three-year license or $300 a year. And then upon renewal, a dealer would look at the number of vehicles they sold in the previous calendar year, and based on the number of vehicles they sold in that prior calendar year, would determine their licensing fee at $600 for a three-year license if they sold 300 vehicles or less. If they sold between 300 vehicles and 1,000 vehicles in the previous year, they'd have $900 for a three-year license. And if they sold over 1,000 vehicles in a three-year period, they'd pay $1,200 for a license. Now, as you can imagine, my larger dealers are not quite so happy with the idea of an original fee that tripled their licensing fee, now quadrupling their licensing fee because they're going from a $900 proposed license to a $1,200 a year proposed license. On the other hand, I also represent small rural dealers, and some of those dealers are benefited by the three-tier licensing because they would fit in either the first or second tier. I would guess that most, if not all, of my dealers fit in the second tier. I may have one or two dealers that would actually fit in the 300 or less category. My guess would be that a bulk of my dealers will fit in the higher category and a small number will fit in the middle tier. But those dealers are seeing an increase from essentially 300 to 600, which is still a substantial increase, but one that would be a little easier for them to take in the current economic climate. So we are here in favor of the Dash 6 amendments to create the tiering system. And I appreciate the work of the chair and the other members of the work group that helped put this together. It has been a long and arduous journey, but I think we're finally there.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We're here to support the concept of a tiered fee system for dealers and also to ask that you consider the Dash 2 amendments. I believe the committee has copies of those. I gave you just a one-page handout. That's a page out of a report published by the Center for Population Research at Portland State University. And it shows the total number of new manufactured homes that were processed by DMV. It's the 1365 number at the bottom of the page. The other numbers have always confused me as to whether those are an annualized number of used homes or existing homes. But it's basically to give you a concept of the relative volume of manufactured homes regulated through the business regulation program, manufactured home transactions. The Dash 2 amendment deals with the concept of a supplemental license. Currently, DMV requires that a dealer have a license or a supplemental license at every location where he sells homes or automobiles. And that makes some sense. It's important that the state oversee those operations. However, that has an unintended consequence when it's applied to manufactured homes. Whenever a dealer takes a home in trade, for example, in a mobile home park, he doesn't just take the home back to a lot. He leaves it there. And because he's now offering that home for sale in that location, he's required to either have a license or a supplemental license at that location. If he puts a new home in a park and offers it for sale on a speculative basis, likewise, he has to have a supplemental license there. What we're proposing in the Dash 2 amendment is that the supplemental license be left at the same price of $90 if it's a manufactured home being offered for sale on a supplemental basis. There may be a windfall to some number of dealers who actually have two operations that are regular street operations, if you will. My guess is there aren't very many of them that operate in that fashion. DMV might be able to tell you exactly how many, but my guess is it's very few. Usually those are incorporated as separate entities. So this is really aimed, though, at the homes that are in parks or in subdivisions or out on rural land, what have you, that they offer for dealers. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
I don't know where my mind is. I was going to say Representative Miner. Don, you support the Dash 6 amendments as well, though?
Yes, I believe.
If you had the Dash 2s, you'd support the Dash 6.
Exactly.
Very good. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Darrell, as you know, my husband was past president of Oregon Auto Deal. It's very difficult for me to sit up and want to argue with an association that has agreed with something. I'm toying with the idea of not appearing to be self-serving because I don't admire that, particularly in elected officials. On the other hand, I want to just say to you and have you respond that in new car dealerships, we hire people to do much of the work that is involved with the Department of Motor Vehicles and actually have very few corrections and very few investigations and do not burden the department with extra work. It is very difficult for me today to see the Oregon Auto Dealers agree that you can triple and quadruple fees on people that work so hard in good partnership. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, for the record, Darrell Fuller again, and thank you. I'll be glad to respond. You'll notice if you look outside the committee room, my heel marks all the way to the door of the committee room in terms of coming here and supporting a tripling or quadrupling of our fees based on the Attorney General's opinion. We did look, by the way, at the licensing fees in other states, and you will find that in the case of where we are doubling and tripling the licensing fee on an annual basis, that brings us into line with what other states are charging for dealer licensing. So in some ways, we're creating a parity because we had been subsidized in the past. Now, I can't, because I don't have the records, indicate that new car dealers generally are better than used car dealers in terms of filling out their paperwork, obviously representing the new car industry. I would tend to think that's accurate. We do have information from the Department of Transportation that suggests that 80% of the time that investigators spend investigating consumer complaints, 80% of that time is spent at used car dealers. So that means about 20% of their investigative time is with either manufactured housing dealers or with new car dealers. So I would argue that you are correct that, for the most part, larger new car dealers, because we have title clerks who actually do the paperwork for a living, as opposed to the salesman in a smaller lot also doing the title and registration work and trying to figure out all the paperwork, that we are better players in the process than you're going to find it. If you were to take the licensing portion of business regulation, just the cost of reviewing a license application, making sure that you have the insurance and the bond, and separate that out from the cost of the investigative or policing part of the administrative agency, I would think that you would find that auto dealers are, that new car dealers are perhaps overpaying. The other part of that, though, is as a citizen, for example, I pay my state taxes every year and am very fortunate that I don't spend a lot of time with the state police because I don't break the law. But I still pay for the state police because they're out there catching the people that do break the law. And if the Department of Motor Vehicles business regulation section is spending 80% of their investigative time going after used car dealers that aren't filling out the paperwork properly, I see that as a benefit to new car dealers because they're out there making sure that the people that aren't doing it right either get out of the business or do it the right way. One of the things that we looked at as we were creating this whole process is there a way to do better cost recovery on the investigative process? And I proposed, and it would still work on in future sessions and perhaps later on in this session, the notion of if a consumer files a complaint against a dealer and the investigation unit has to send somebody out to make sure a dealer's doing their paperwork the right way, maybe that dealer ought to have an investigative cost assessed to them. Every time an investigator comes out, the dealer has to pay $50 for the cost of that investigation. Now, there's a danger there. One of the things that we have steadfastly opposed is that the Business Regulation Division does fine dealers when they do make mistakes. Paperwork isn't transferred in a timely manner, something gets lost, and those investigative, those fines that DMV assesses on dealers, both new and used, go into the general fund. They do not go to support the Business Regulation Division, and we looked at using that revenue as a way to reduce the licensing costs. But our concern with that is that gives the agency an incentive to fine people. And we're not looking for providing the agency with the cliche is you have the small town cop writing tickets to pay a salary. You don't want to provide an incentive for the agents to go out there and nickel and dime dealers to death for small violations that normally they would correct without a fine, and give them an incentive to create lots of fines because that helps supplement their program. So we continue to oppose, even though it increases our licensing costs, the idea of using other revenues like fines as a way to supplement the program. So there are a lot of different things that we've looked at as ways to supplement the program, but I would simply, while it's no fun to pay a licensing fee or tripling a fee for a license when your interactions with that agency are substantially limited, I would suggest to you that you wear that as a crown of indication that you're doing a good job, and the less you deal with it, the better off you are, because that indicates that you're doing it the right way. And if there are ways that we can find enough support to generate additional revenue for investigative costs that separates from the licensing costs, then certainly OADA would support that. The reason we're supporting the amendments you have presented today is that the alternative to that would be have the agency cut administrative positions and cut investigators, where instead of, I think the agency now has 6 investigators for the entire state, if they don't get the kind of revenue they need to continue their program, then they're going to cut 2 or 3 investigators or 3 or 4 investigators, and you have even fewer people out there policing the auto dealers that aren't doing a good job. And I would say that in your community or in any community, if there are dealers out there that aren't doing a good job, that you would want to have an investigator out there making sure that they follow up and get their work done. And if we don't supply the agency with that revenue, they're not going to have the investigators to keep the bad guys in line.
further questions? Any questions for Mr. Miner regarding the supplemental? That clear as mud to everybody. Representative Merkley.
Mr. Miner, with this modification as Representative Dash 2, are we still okay with the AG's report?
Before you answer that,
senior moment. You're elected.
Before you answer,
not even a senior.
The only comment I would make is if you leave the fee at its existing spot, you lose $83,000 approximately of additional revenue right here. You go from 90 to 230, 595, about $83,000 of additional revenue. So the program theoretically would be reduced by $83,300. And you can comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I don't know whether this has that tremendous of an impact on the program that it would take them out of compliance. I suspect not.
And that would be maybe a question, a follow-up question with DMV. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I may make just one other comment. I pulled it out, Darrell Fuller, in for the record. Just as an example for the committee, in the state of Washington, a dealer license is $250 a year, which would be $750 for a three-year license for our neighbor to the north. So dealers in Oregon would be paying, depending on how they're tiered, those dealers paying $600 would be a little bit less. Those paying $900 would be a little bit more. Obviously, dealers in the larger end would be paying substantially more than Washington to $250 a year because they don't have a tiered system. And also realize that other states don't have constitutional amendments that prohibit other funds from supplementing their programs. So Oregon is in somewhat of a unique state in terms of not being able to allow some of those other funds to be used.
Mr. Chair, may I make one more remark? Last legislature, the state went from a one-year license to a three-year license. Previous to that, a supplemental license was $30 per year. Generally, these homes don't stay in a park, or a dealer isn't offering them for more than a year. And so actually, after the last session, we saw a tripling of this supplemental license in effect, because we paid for 3 years, but you probably only enjoyed them a year or less.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll have Commissioner Lindley and Bill Penhollow next.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. With me today is Commissioner Don Lindley from Lincoln County. You'll note on my testimony that Cam Gilmore, who is the Director of Transportation and Development for Clackamas County, had intended to be here, but called this morning and indicated that something came up in his county and could not attend the hearing this morning, but certainly wanted to indicate his support for House Bill 2139. AOC is in support of this measure, and I would request that Commissioner Lindley present his testimony, and then I have just a few comments at the end.
Thanks, Bill. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't want to repeat comments that have already been made by the department, but just to let you know that our association spent a great deal of time looking at various transportation issues prior to the session. It was our recommendation to our board that we not look for opportunities to bring anything forward, but rather to support specific bills that would be beneficial to counties. This is one of those bills. We support the increase that is authorized in 2139. And as you've heard already, the DMV operation is being subsidized by the State Highway Fund. And this has some significant impact on counties. county's share, the state highway fund, and we've provided information about the percentages of what counties and cities would receive if this bill is passed. I might just mention the notion of phasing in or that kind of thing. A number of years ago, our county had not adjusted a number of our fees for a decade or more, much like the DMV has not. And we determined that we needed to charge a fair fee for service that was being provided, and that made some fairly significant increases of 100 to 200%. And that was difficult to do, but we had to remember that actually for many years those fees were not covering the costs, and folks were getting a pretty good deal. We've now changed that in our county, and we annually look at fees, and we make small adjustments based on actual costs, and that seems to have worked much, much better than waiting for 15 years or longer and making a big adjustment. So I would urge you in the future, in this body, to consider regular reviews of fees and make regular small adjustments rather than the large ones that are proposed. Our bottom line is that, in our opinion, resources are inadequate to repair and maintain our highway, road, and street system in the state of Oregon. We need all the money that we can get, certainly, to maintain our city streets, county roads, and state highways. We want the state highway fund to do what it's intended to do, not to pay for the operation of DMV. So we urge your support of 2139.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, for the record again, Bill Penhollow with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I just want to add briefly a couple of points to Commissioner Lindley's comments. With the passage of 2139 and the increase in the DMV fees, you're aware of the revenues that would additional revenues that would flow to the state highway fund. The figures that I have in my testimony are slightly different, I believe, than what was heard this morning, but I believe they do not reflect the dash six changes that are before the committee, but would mention to the committee that 60% of that would go to ODOT, 24%, slightly more than 24% to the counties, and a little over 15% to the cities. And I have provided you a table with my testimony that would show what those increases would be county by county. Looking at this next fiscal year 2001-2002 would be about $5 million, and the following fiscal year about $7 million. Be extremely helpful in the maintenance and preservation of county roads and bridges, and we would certainly encourage the committee to act favorably on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there specific questions?
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one question, please, of Ms. Sharon?
Mm-hmm.
Just curious, when we looked at the budget, and if this is correct, we showed that you have 915 people employed in the DMV, and your personnel are $80 million, and your total budget is almost $127 million. Is this actual factual?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, are we talking about the governor's recommended budget, or are we talking about current biennium? I'm sorry, I'm not quite clear.
Yes, this is current biennium, as I understand it.
In the current biennium, our budget at DMV is approximately $116 million, and we have about 870 positions at the DMV.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The question I guess I have then is, you know, this is only $33 million of that cost. How is the rest of this budget paid for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the entire budget is paid for by all. Essentially, we're an other-funded agency, and all of our expenses are paid for by fees that we charge for the various transactions. The DMV creates a net positive revenue to the highway fund, so we raise more money than we spend within the DMV. What this bill would do was it would increase that net positive cash flow to the highway fund by another $23 million.
So last follow-up, Mr. Chair, please.
Yes, last follow-up.
So I want to understand correctly, mm-hmm. You know, to be in compliance with this opinion of the Attorney General, does this mean that just these services were, quote, illegal, or the entire division of DMV could not be paid out of state highway funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, only very few of the transactions and services that we provide fell into the category of being ineligible for highway funds. And those two categories are the ID card and about 65% of the business regulation program, which is still about a $3-point-some million program. So only a small portion of DMV activities fell into that category, and they are dealt with by the fee bill, by this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Andrea? If you can keep your testimony very brief, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Folk with the League of Oregon Cities. I have with me a mayor from, I don't have with me a mayor from the City of Enterprise. I have with me a letter on her behalf.
The invisible mayor.
Yes. she's sitting right here. The mayor from the City of Enterprise is the current president of the League of Oregon Cities, and she couldn't be with us today, but she would like to, on behalf of cities in Oregon, urge your support of House Bill 2139. I'll just briefly echo some comments that you heard from the counties. You've heard us talk about funding. The current state of our system, maintenance and preservation, the funding gap alone for the city system for fiscal year 2001-2003 biennium is over $100 million. So any opportunity we have to put some money back into the road fund, we would appreciate your support. And again, thank you for your leadership and being willing to address the transportation funding issue. With that, I'll take any questions.
I'm not going to allow anybody to ask you.
Okay. Thank you.
Craig Campbell. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm representing AAA, and I know you have a short time frame, so I'll be brief as well. AAA, as a policy matter, supports the idea of administrative costs being funded through whatever apparatus is used to fund those administrative costs. We don't like the idea of programs that serve our members having to be subsidized out of the highway fund, because that is a fund that is fairly limited in its use. We prefer that the dollars there go to highways rather than going to administrative costs. We're in support of 2139. We're supportive of the Dash 5 and the Dash 6 amendments, and I did want to take the opportunity to thank the chair for the efforts that he has gone through to navigate the administrative, navigate the problems that were raised by the Attorney General's office successfully, and I wanted to thank him for that effort. And unless there are any questions, I just wanted to indicate the support of my membership.
Thank you. Thank you, Craig. Appreciate it. That exhausts the list of folks that have signed up on 2139. We have some amendments on the table here, and in order to move them, we need to actually go back to legislative council and kind of combine those before we can go forward with that. I will be back in touch with each of you. I'll make the rounds again, and hopefully we can do this and get a work session next week on the bill. I regret to do this, but I have a letter from Monty King, the lobbyist for the independent auto dealers, and
the invisible Monty King.
Yeah, and this letter speaks for itself. It's not the message that I would like to have heard this morning, so pass that out. I intend to work the other two bills. intend to work the other two bills. If I can keep a quorum, I think we can do those bills and get those off of our plate. So, Representative Cruz is here. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2139. And Representative Cruz, do you wish to testify on both bills? What we'll do is we'll open a public hearing on both House Bill 2657 and House Bill 2924. And John, can you give us just a brief?
Yes, Chair Starr. House Bill 2657 expands offensive reckless driving to include driving at speed greater than 95 miles per hour, punishes by possible license suspension, a maximum of 1 year imprisonment, $5,000 fine, or both. Members, you should have before you the proposed -1 amendment for this bill. It does two things, primarily changes from a 95 mile per hour standard to changes to over 30 miles per hour in excess of the designated speed limit or any posted speed. And the second thing it does, it creates an exemption for operator of emergency vehicle or operating in course of official duty. And as far as regarding House Bill 2924, that's before you, creates an offense of violating maximum speed limit. It deletes federal maximum speed limit, provides default speed limits, and makes related changes. You have before you also the proposed -3, applies mainly to Section 8 of the bill, and is regarding a new definition of when children are present in a school zone. Also should mention that there is an issue that I was just notified about 6 o'clock last night regarding the fines that you would be changing into this bill to a Class B infraction. Basically, you're in Senate Bill 20, as I recall, it applies to Statute 811. I can just get that 811.109. That is a baseline incremental application as far as fines are concerned. For example, if you went 1 mile above the speed limit in the context of House Bill 2657, the fine could potentially be $77. Or let's say, for example, from 11 miles to 20 miles above the speed limit would be $109. By inserting the Class B infraction, you are circumventing Senate Bill 20, which was passed in the 99 legislature, and if someone was in violation of this bill, the fine would be, as long as they're not endangering anyone as they're violating, it would be $175 minimum fine. If they are endangering, it would be $235. This bill, if passed, will have to go to Ways and Means because there is a significant fiscal on actually both bills, House Bill 2924 and 2657. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jeff Cruz, State Representative, District 45. For those who were around in 99, remember I'm the one that got up on the floor and said that I always drive at 74 on the freeway. So really, this is not in my best interest. Both of these bills came to me basically from conversations I had with road troopers and some of their frustrations. 2657 basically came to the fact that we have a two-tiered fine structure in the state of Oregon. And so basically, if you're on the freeway for doing 87 miles an hour, the fine's going to be the same as if you're doing 187, and that seems somewhat absurd to me. And if you get down to my part of the state, there are sections of the freeway where they hit people that are doing in excess of 100 on a regular basis. And so that was the original intent of the bill, was to just deal with the problem on I-5. And, you know, they can't be cited for reckless driving for going that speed, but it's another level of proof that they have to create. And so what I originally intended to do was just create another fine structure, and this is what we came to. And then in conversations with folk from the state police on the original bill, they said, we got some problems here because in hot pursuit of somebody, we could be violating the law, and we don't want to do that. So that was why the one addition was in. But then in looking at it, we decided that maybe it would be better to broaden it because because obviously if you're in a school zone and you're doing 55 miles an hour, that is reckless driving because there are kids there. So this is much broader than the original bill. I think a much better bill. And this is basically under the premise that, you know, you can't go this fast, folks. And so there's going to be a higher level of penalty if you're doing that sort of activity. House Bill 2924, with the full knowledge that, number one, that there were going to be bills to increase the speed limit in the state, I thought maybe we ought to actually have a speed limit in the state. We've been a basic rule state. This does not vacate basic rule because it will still be there for adverse conditions at lower speeds, and I think that's appropriate. But this was another one where the troopers say, you know, we have to spend a whole lot of time in court when we cite folks and they challenge it. And with this, it's cut and dried. It's clear. When there's a speed limit, you exceed the speed limit, you get a ticket, that's it. You know, and so part of the design of this is to have our troopers who are supposed to protect and serve actually spend more time protecting and serving and less time sitting in court dealing with traffic offenses. Having a speed limit, I think, works well if indeed the Senate bill that increases the speed limit works, because one of the fears was we're at 65 now and people are doing 72, 73, and if we go to 75, that people would do an 82, 83, and that certainly isn't something I would like to see. And so if we increase the speed on I-5 to 70, then 70 is what you can do. And because we don't want to become the Autobahn in the state of Oregon, certainly. So I think these are both good sense pieces of legislation. I did this with the safety of the public and the ability of the state troopers to actually enforce law and spend more time actually on the road than in court. So with that, I'd answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Tim Cruz?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Cruz, thank you for educating us on this. There's a piece of this that is new to me. I had always assumed that if there's a speed limit posted, that the law is that you have to obey the speed limit. And I think I heard you say that actually that's not the case, that we're a basic rule state, did you call it? So what does that mean under current law? It means that I can exceed the speed limit if it's safe to do so?
That's a defense you could use, yes. In a basic rule state, what we have when you see a sign on I-5 is the suggested speed, and but it is the standard. And this isn't saying that, you know, we'd have to change signs, say speed limit, I guess, but basically the idea behind a basic rule is that as long as you're operating safely for the environment, you're okay. And the basic rule allows, which is why we left it in for adverse conditions. If it's pea soup fog and black ice, you shouldn't be doing 65. You should be doing a much lower speed. So we still have ability to control that. But you could, if you were given a ticket, you could go to court and maintain it was dry road, broad daylight, low traffic, and so you know what you were doing was appropriate. And this. And which it, the frustration of troopers is that they have to go in court and testify on all this stuff. And so this would keep them on the road where they're supposed to be.
You're giving me this information a little late for some of my phone tickets.
We've got Troy Casales and Bill Cross kind of to testify. There's no other questions for Representative
Cruz. Mr. Chair, far be it from me to ever exceed the speed limit on the freeway and announce such a thing on the House floor. But not a bad idea, actually. We're actually deleting the federal speed limit, however, on the freeway in 2924, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Representative? And this bill doesn't replace it with anything in anticipation of the Senate bill passing that would replace it.
This bill doesn't change any speed limits that currently exist, but there is a Senate bill that would adjust it. This bill, everything stays the same as far as what the speeds are, but the state does have the ability to adjust the speed on interstate roads.
Okay.
So,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only parting comment I would have as a good representative is I'll probably just vote no on these bills because you vote no on mine.
Not all of them.
Bill and Troy.
Speed limit. Saying that state.
Troy, you signed up to testify only on 2924. Did you want to testify on that bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation, testifying solely on House Bill 2924, and I will go quick again. The federal maximum speed limit was created during the energy crisis in the 1970s. That's when 55 was on all interstates. In 1987, the federal government allowed the rural interstate limits to then go increase to 65 miles per hour, which is where Oregon is today. In 1995, Congress repealed the law which allows the state to set their own limits at their own discretion. However, in the state of Oregon, we have not changed our speed laws at any point in time, so we still do have reference to federal maximum speed limit in our statute. This bill takes that out. This bill also, and by creating a limit and applying the limit everywhere and allowing basic rule to be at the officer discretion as described in statute, it will provide much clearer information to the public, to law enforcement and courts, so there isn't the confusion of where are we when we're in a limit, where are we when we're in basic rule. And as Representative Cruz had pointed out, it also brings up efficiency gains for law enforcement and for courts. The two things I'd like to bring up about this particular bill. First, if it can be in the staff report, somewhere mentioned that the current signs as posted on all roads, city, county, and state, are applicable for this bill if passed, and you do not have to add the word limit. Adding the word limit means all the signs need to be changed, and that's millions of dollars all across the state on all roads. Currently, signs don't have the word limit. Where there is limits, we just want to make sure there isn't the understanding that all the signs are going to be replaced and now put the word limit in there. The second item is in Section 6, Subsection 2 of the bill, because of the serious traffic violation program that DMV has, it is a requirement for two of our funding sources, the Motor Carrier Safety Funds, MXSAP funds, and the Surface Transportation Funds, the STP funds that come into Oregon. We need to retain some sort of connection. So when the officer writes a citation for somebody either under a limit or on a basic rule, if that's the case, that they have the ability to write down the speed of the motorist and what the limit is at the time so they can differentiate when that person is 15 miles an hour or above, keeps us in compliance and one of the prerequisites for those two funding sources. So supplied with you at the bottom of the testimony page there, the language that could go into subsection 1, it keeps us in compliance so that we don't come into jeopardy of losing between $5.5 and $6 million with the federal funds because of the requirement for the serious traffic violation program. This bill would provide clarity and consistency for speed law in the state of Oregon. And with that, Mr. Chairman, happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair?
So with those suggested amendments, then the bill would be okay with you.
Mr. Chairman, particularly the second piece, the first one I think can be carried in a staff report. I don't think it's needed to be an amendment.
Troy, in regard, thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to the deletion of the word limit, can't you just add a sign below an existing sign that says limit on it, a smaller sign that just tucks up underneath and you just bolt it onto the signpost? That can't be that expensive.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, that is possible, but you're talking about thousands upon thousands of signs all over the state because limit would apply on all roads now for this bill. So city impact, county impact, and state impact.
Right.
Other questions? Mr. Cross, you want to first address House Bill 2924, and then we'll deal with that, and then we'll go to the other bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Public hearing on both.
Committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association. We are here in support of House Bill 2924 with the amendments that were mentioned earlier. We One, and I won't really add to what Mr. Cruz has represented in terms of the need for this change, but one good situation I think was pointed out in the testimony that Jim Botwinus asked me to distribute, wherein right now, for example, on 18 or 22 safety highway safety corridors in one county, they may not, with the basic speed rule, the judges may not, in fact, look at anything over or under 75. Next county, they may be willing to cite at 60, or, you know, convict at 65. So it's also a differential between how the counties and the judges look at these violations. So we could use this. The maximum speed limit would be a very helpful in terms of certainty of violations, and that would be the only comment I would add to what Mr. Cruz already discussed with you.
Would you have any heartburn if we reinstated the section that Troy mentioned, section 6 sub 2?
I don't believe we would, Mr. Chair. I'll double check, but I don't believe we would.
Okay. Further questions? Any questions? Okay. Let's if you could address the other bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, very briefly, on 2657, the Oregon State Police Officers Association would also like to go on record in support of that. Again, that would be an additional tool that we could use, and it would be very helpful in certain situations using a 30-mile adjustment for reckless driving, because then we wouldn't necessarily have to have the other elements to use in getting a conviction or citing a ticket.
Other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, before we go to work session, I think we should relatively soon. I was just kidding about not voting for these bills earlier.
Very good. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2657 and 2924. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2657.
Mr. Chair, I move...
Dash one.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2657.
The dash one.
The dash one amendments.
Representative Krupp has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2657. Is there objection? So moved. This bill has to go away from me. Right?
And Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2657 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Krupp has moved House Bill 2657 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation. Is there objection? And then so moved. And we will close the work session, House Bill 2657. We're adjourned. I want to thank the committee for hanging in there with us here. Next week, we start at 8 o'clock, and we have session starts at 10. We just need the committee to be here on time as much as is possible. You might contact Pat Egan in the governor's office if you want to ride in or drive an alternative fuel vehicle next week on Tuesday.